Welcome back to the first episode of the Educated Patient Podcast in 2026. Today, we're joined by Dr. Siegel, and our conversation will be centered around, I want to say fad, but it's not a fad. It's more so a movement, I think, at this point, where a lot of individuals capitalize on the energy of the new year and take advantage of that to have themselves a dry January. And Dr. Siegel is here to help us unpack the physical implications of that, the mental implications of that, the health implications, if you do practice dry January or you're thinking about doing that. So we're excited to dive into this convo. Dr. Siegel, thank you for joining us. We'd love for you to start us off by just introducing yourself and we'll get it going from there.
Yeah. So I'm Dr. Michael Siegel. I am a professor in the public health and community medicine department in the Tufts University School of Medicine. And much of my research focuses on alcohol, looking at the health effects, looking at the different types of alcohol. And also I do a lot of work on youth drinking and methods to get people to stop drinking, and also policy, looking at alcohol policy and the effects of policy on helping to reduce alcohol misuse.
What was a moment in schooling or your professional career as it went on where you were like, I want to go into alcohol study and practice?
Well, I mean, I think clearly for me, it was a combination of two things. One was seeing patients with end-stage liver disease in during my internship and residency. And just seeing how debilitating alcohol can be. And the second thing was just having the experience of knowing people who were killed in drunk driving crashes, which definitely, you know, hits hard and makes you realize the tremendous impact that alcohol can have on life. So I think those two experiences are what really drew me into this field.
At a high level, before we dive deep into dry January specifically, what are some of the immediate benefits? We don't necessarily need to talk about the negative implications, but what are some of the immediate benefits of somebody who doesn't drink regularly, or maybe used to drink a lot and they pulled back? Like, what are some of the quickest things that start to come back for these individuals when alcohol or the volume of alcohol starts to come down for them?
So there's really two things that happen right away. The first one has to do with effects on the gastrointestinal tract. So alcohol is it's really tough for the GI tract. It can cause stomach irritation, stomach bleeding. It can exacerbate ulcers. So the first thing that you know is kind of reduced or resolved is any of the kind of gastric GI effects of alcohol. That will pretty much go away just about right away because you're no longer exposed to it. And the second relatively, you know, quick effect of stopping drinking are really mental health aspects of it that people probably don't realize how much of an effect alcohol has on their mental health. And when you remove it, you start to repair, you know, some of those effects. And so people can see pretty immediate changes in their mood, in their stability, in their ability to relate to other people. And, you know, that can be a relatively quick effect.
And the gut brain connection and gut microbiome seems to be like a hot topic for just normal, like myself, like a normal person. It's very talked about. And when you were mentioning the immediate effects on the GI tract, I'm curious how much of that ties into that conversation, because it seems to be something people are very aware of these days.
Yeah, I honestly I don't know. I don't. I'm not an expert on all of the kind of microbiome literature, and so I'm not. I really don't know the extent to which alcohol plays into that aspect. But it's what's very clear is that alcohol is a direct has a direct effect, especially on the lining of the stomach, and even before you get to the rest of the gut, before you even get to the intestines, really it's the upper GI tract where you really have severe effects, potential effects of alcohol.
What about sleep? I know for myself, I know if I have one glass of wine, like I already know my sleep is going to be different than if I don't. And there's a cost benefit relationship that you have to weigh with that. And I'm curious, like, why is that with sleep? Like, why can such a little dose, relatively speaking, impact sleep so much?
Well, I mean, so alcohol, does affect the neurotransmitters in the brain. It has a, it's a drug. It really is. It's a drug, and like other drugs, it has an effect on the brain. It affects neurotransmitters, and some of those neurotransmitters are involved in sleep. We know that, for example, serotonin is higher levels of it help to induce feeling of being tired and sleep, and so that's one of the neurotransmitters that can be affected by alcohol. So it really does have what we would call psychoactive effects, like other psychoactive drugs, and I think people I think underestimate that. They think of it as a beverage more than a drug. And it is a, substance. When we talk about substance abuse, we're talking about basically smoking, alcohol, and then other drugs, illicit drugs for the most part. So it is, it's a drug. It needs to be considered in that category.
It's an interesting drug, especially when it with regards to sleep, because I know for many people at the end of a stressful day, it's an easy way for you to feel mellowed out from the stress or the rush of the day. And I even know from my own experience, right? Like that one glass of wine makes me feel tired and then I go to sleep, but then there's this weird thing that happens in the middle of the night where my body like almost wakes up. Like I don't stay in that tiredness for some reason. I kind of like cycle out of it and becomes interrupted sleep. It's not deep.
Well, the thing that is causing that, and what people need to think about, is the fact that withdrawal from alcohol, even a small amount, has ne potentially negative effects. So while it may be very helpful in getting you to fall asleep, as the alcohol level then drops, you start to get kind of withdrawal effects, and that could be leading you to the other direction. So it may cause you to wake up in the middle of the night because, the alcohol had kind of had a effect that kind of swung the pendulum one direction, but then once it dissipates, and it's metabolized, the pendulum's going to swing back and it may go further in the other direction. It makes it a lot harder for the body to kind of regulate processes like sleep. I think most people are familiar with the hangover effect that, you might drink and it might provide a feeling of relaxation and pleasure, but the next morning, you have kind of this withdrawal or rebound effect, where you can have, severe symptoms or even just mild symptoms, where you're just not quite yourself.
For those that are listening that are like, I'm never gonna not drink alcohol to some extent, but obviously I want to be conscious of the amount that I'm consuming. I'm curious from your lens, are there any I don't know, supplements or things that are out there that can help this process in conjunction? Like, let's say, for example, drink a glass of wine, and there's this supplement that I could take that might help me metabolize it faster or something like that to speed through the process or the extraction, you called it, or the withdrawal.
So the only thing that I'm aware of that maybe helps with the metabolism is having food with alcohol. It having food in the stomach with the alcohol does help to absorb it more quickly, and it will help to prevent the effects of alcohol. There's no real way to change your metabolism. That is something that's kind of genetic, and people have different rates of alcohol metabolism, and there's not really any way to regulate that. So the only thing that people can control is making sure that they're not drinking on an empty stomach, and the more they're able to kind of integrate food in with alcohol, and have a balance, the less likely they are to have acute effects, acute adverse effects.
Got it. So more pizza.
It's, having a beer with a pizza or something, is probably a better strategy than, just going to a bar and drinking a bunch of beers.
Love it. You touched a little bit on the mental health side. I'm curious just to hear a little bit more around cognitive function. And I know from experience, there'll be, let's say, for example, it's a holiday weekend. In my, and maybe this is overthinking in my own mind, but I'll feel some type of cognitive impact of that holiday weekend, not just for the next day. It'll take 2, 3 days until I feel 100% sharp again. Is there any truth to that? Or is like, is that something that's relative to the individual and the way that they metabolize the alcohol? Like, what's going on in that realm cognitively?
Well, it's I mean, first of all, yes, there are very stark individual differences. So it's really hard to generalize how any individual is going to react. People have different metabolic rates for alcohol, and different tolerances. And so, it's really hard to just make a generalization. But I think there's a couple things that are important. The first one is that some, maybe surprisingly, even at a relatively low dose, alcohol significantly impairs cognitive function. So most people probably understand that the typical level that's considered drunk driving is 0.10, blood alcohol concentration of 0.10. Well, I was involved in a study. One of my colleagues actually is an does a lot of research in this area, but we did a study of students at a Marine academy that were it basically was a simulation where they were on the bridge of a ship, and they were having to control the ship and navigate it through different obstacles. And what we found is that even at a 0.06 level, which is not drunk, it's maybe a drink or two for some people, it significantly impaired their cognitive ability in terms of steering the ship, such that had this not been a simulation, they would have crashed into some obstacle, an iceberg or whatever's out there. So it's not, a lot of people think, okay, as long as I keep under 0.10 and I'm not drunk, it's not going to affect my cognitive ability. Even at a low dose, even at 0.06 and possibly even 0.04, in some of the studies, even down at the 0.04 level, it's starting to impact significantly your cognitive function. The second thing is that because of the psychoactive effects that we were talking about and the change in neurotransmitters, alcohol can have long-lasting effects even after you withdraw from the alcohol and it's not physically in your system. The effects that it's had on the brain and on the neurotransmitters can last a while. And so it's very plausible that the effects that you're describing are directly attributable to drinking.
Interesting. I'm curious how many students ran to sign up for that study.
So it was an interesting study because it was people were provided with free beer basically. So they essentially had a drinking party, and they were they were told how much to drink because we needed to get the blood level at just at the right amount. But yeah, it was kind of that's how we averaged. We didn't have any problem getting subjects for that. It was they all volunteered and got the free beer and then got to plan the simulator.
Speaking of the social side, I know drinking is very social, right? And it's hard to exist in many circles of life, especially as an adult in a social setting where drinking isn't part of it to some degree. For somebody that's considering Dry January or even just stopping drinking altogether, how would you help somebody wrap their mind around navigating that barrier of like, well, how are my friends going to think about me? What about my family? And just dealing with potentially saying, thinking like, I'm not even going to have any friends because a lot of our stuff revolves around that.
Yeah, so I think that there's a couple of strategies, and I think the number one strategy is, and I don't know that a lot of people think about this, but finding somebody else or other people to join you in that effort is, potentially the greatest thing that you can do. Because what it's doing is it's actually giving you social support in that effort. And so rather than the social, peer influences acting to try to get you to drink, now you've got peer influences that are kind of reinforcing and empowering you to stop drinking. So, finding other people, it's when one person does something, it's a lot harder for them to resist if they're the only one who's not drinking, say, at a gathering. But if other people are doing it and you're doing it in concert with someone else, then it's much easier. And I think the second thing is letting other people know, talking to them and making it clear to them that this is a major initiative that you're doing in trying to change your life in that way, and that that they'll understand if you express to them that yeah, this is a it's a New Year's resolution, this is what I'm trying to do. And especially your family, letting the family know, because you can get a lot of support from family or and also close friends.
Do you have any real life examples or experiences, maybe personally or with patients, where removing alcohol opened up healthier conversation or life experience, or had a very recognizable positive impact, not just on themselves, but on their social circle or their family life that's immediately around them?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and this is where I saw this most was working in psychiatry and working with people with mental illness or mental health issues. Getting alcohol out of the equation was a game changer. It doesn't mix well with mental health problems. It tends to exacerbate almost any mental health problem that you can think of, depression, anxiety. It tends to exacerbate all of those types of conditions. So I think where the not just one, but I've seen hundreds of cases of people who they're involved in mental health treatment, and as part of that, we can get them to abstain from alcohol, and you start to see real significant mental health benefits.
Interesting. I know I don't want to say the generation below me, but let's say a few age brackets below me and really around like the college age and post-college right now. This is totally just an observation, but I feel as if there's been a huge shift with the perception, the utilization, the engagement, to use big words, with alcohol. Like it just seems as if the younger, like 20, let's call it 20 to 30 year olds, it's just different than it was for even like my parents and my generation coming up through college. Is that something that you've recognized as well, socially, and in addition to that, like, what do you think some of the contributing factors are to that shift?
So, you know, if you look at the long-term trends, there has been a decrease in levels of alcohol use among youth and young people. So if you kind of go back, you know, historically over the past two or three decades, the kind of overall levels of alcohol use are decreasing. So that's good news. However, there are some trends that are problematic. And so one of those trends is the use of alcohol with caffeine. So we didn't, I guess in our generation, we didn't have these caffeinated alcoholic beverages. But in the current generation, caffeinated alcoholic beverages, we call them CABs, have become relatively common. I've done research on that, and we've found that caffeine greatly increases the effects, the adverse effects of alcohol. And, you know, it's a synergistic effect where the two interact with each other. And we found that the consumption of caffeinated alcoholic beverages is tied to increased adverse effects, increased fighting, increased violence, any, you know, you name it, all of the different consequences of alcohol use are exacerbated. So that's one trend. A second trend that I think is kind of been a little under the radar, but it's really important, is that the alcohol companies have been, one of their strategies to increase consumption, since it has been dropping, is to essentially rebrand common drinks that people, you know, young people like, for example, lemonade or cider or seltzer or soda, and to rebrand those as alcoholic beverages, right? So now you start to see all kinds of alcoholic ciders, alcohol seltzers, alcohol mixed with soda, and, you know, we didn't have before, you know, I know in my generation, you know, sometimes youth would young people would create the mix themselves, you know, so they'd take, you know, Coca-Cola and put some Jack Daniels in. But now you don't even have to do that because it comes pre-packaged. And one of the reasons why that's kind of dangerous and insidious is that it's taking advantage of the fact that people, like young people, you know, they like cider, they like seltzer, they like soda, they drink a lot of those beverages. And so it's kind of normalizing alcohol use by turning all of those into alcoholic beverages.
Interesting. This is totally not of this conversation, but the same strategy that you described with the alcohol companies blending with these favorite products is also happening in the supplement world too, with, you know, protein products and all that kind of stuff is really trying to take advantage of these things that maybe even were popular when we were kids, and they bring them back to life, right? And of course there's the novelty to it as well as the consumer.
It's really it's actually a very smart marketing technique. And you know, anytime that you can kind of tie your product to something that's already popular, you know, then you've already done, you're halfway there, because you've already got the demand, the consumer demand is already there, and you're just rebranding your product. So it is a effective marketing strategy.
What are some questions that you would encourage a listener to ask themselves to decide, you know, how does alcohol fit into my life? I guess reflective questions or questions that can challenge their beliefs of alcohol.
So I think the biggest one that people probably don't think about is, how is alcohol affecting my relationships? It's not the first, you know, if you ask people what are the harms of alcohol, most likely they're going to say, well, you can get drunk, it has acute effects, it has health effects, it affects your cognition, you can have hangovers. I don't think most people would say, well, it affects my relationships. But that is absolutely one of the most powerful effects that alcohol has, is it really does affect people's relationships. It often interferes with relationships. It tends to make people more aggressive, more violent, maybe get into more arguments. And that has repercussions beyond just, you know, the acute effects of the violence or aggressiveness. It can actually completely alter someone's relationship. And so, you know, the only way to really test that out is to abstain for a while and see, how is it affecting your relationships? Thinking about that. And that's why this Dry January concept is such an intriguing idea, because it actually allows people for the first time to recognize, how is alcohol affecting me? How is it affecting my life? How is it affecting my mental health? How is it affecting how I feel about myself? How is it affecting my relationships? And, you know, if you're just drinking and you don't stop, you're not going to really know that. You need to, you know, by experimenting with refraining from alcohol for a while, you get a sense of, okay, you know, I didn't realize that this was really having that effect on my relationships, and look how different things are now. So I think that's what I would really focus on, is how does it affect more social aspects of your life, communication and relationships with other people. I think that's probably the biggest effect that alcohol has that people tend not to recognize.
If I'm abstaining from alcohol for the first time in a really long time, or this is my first Dry January, how can I, or what can I put into play as systems or processes or habits that can help me navigate Dry January in a more manageable way? Because I imagine for a lot of people, it's looking at potentially doing Dry January is a huge mountain to climb, right? There's a ton of things stacked against their ability to say yes to doing it. So how can I more manageably take the step and commit to it?
So I think that the most effective way of kind of facilitating somebody, and this doesn't just apply to alcohol, but for any drug, the best way to facilitate and enhance someone's ability to abstain from it is to find a substitute. And by substitute, I don't mean another drug. I mean some sort of activity or pursuit that can kind of take the place of drinking. It's hard to just give something up. It's a lot easier to trade something, right? Nobody wants to just give something up and not get anything back. But people are very willing to make trades. And so what I suggest is that people make a trade rather than just giving up alcohol. You trade the alcohol for something else. And, you know, it may be different for different people. I think for many, many people, exercise and physical activity can be what you trade for. Along with being, you know, the timing of this kind of times simultaneously with New Year's resolutions. And so a lot of people make a New Year's resolution to get more physical activity, more exercise. So it kind of works hand in hand. But we see this with other drugs as well. I mean, with smoking cessation, the most effective way for people to quit smoking is to do it in concert with starting some other activity, so that there's something substituting for it. You know, exercise is just one example. It could be dancing, doing arts, you know, playing music, playing a sport. It could be anything, really. It doesn't really matter what it is. It's just the importance of being able to kind of make this a trade rather than just a loss.
What are your favorite go-to resources to direct people to if they're contemplating or they're curious and you recognize that there's potential for them to increase their readiness to take the leap?
So I think that the most important resources are the ones that are relationships in people's lives. So not necessarily going to a website, you know, and looking up something, but think about the relationships you have that alcohol is relevant to. And the number one relationship you have is with your doctor. So I think that talking to your physician about this is incredibly helpful. And you know, it helps to make this a plan that you're making with your physician. And that, you know, I think really helps people to change their behavior, because now it kind of has the blessing of their doctor, or there's an involvement of their doctor in this. So number one, I think discussing this with your physician or other healthcare relationships that you might have. And second is, you know, talking to other people who have had this experience. I think having social support, having a support group, is probably much more important than, you know, just reading an article online to get advice. I think people like to hear things from other people, and they benefit from hearing other people's experience, and they benefit from having social support. So I think that finding other people, or even a whole community of people who are going through the same thing, is really a wonderful way to help people navigate through this.
Love that. Relationships, we keep coming back to that. And unfortunately, there are times when it's beyond that, right? And they do need to seek help. So what about in the scenario where I've come to terms and I'm being honest with myself and I'm ready to ask for help? What are the resources, people, or places that you encourage people to reach out to when they're ready to get help, when it's beyond just, you know, it's out of their, they feel like it's out of their control, essentially?
Yeah. So I think, you know, Alcohol Anonymous and other organizations similar to it are kind of the mainstay of this work. You know, they've been doing this work for decades. And Alcohol Anonymous in particular has a very well established 12-step program that has been shown to be effective. There are other 12-step programs or similar programs. There are a lot of alcohol detoxification programs, alcohol support groups. You know, there's really a ton of resources out there that people can choose from. I think that, you know, again, the most important thing is having that social support. And so, you know, doing this with other people is important. And that's why, you know, a group like Alcoholics Anonymous is so effective. One of the reasons it's effective is because, you know, you're not going there just by yourself. You're meeting a whole group of other people who are all trying to achieve the same end and have all experienced the same problems. And so it's like the group is kind of quitting together. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are a lot of groups, there are a lot of support groups, a lot of detoxification programs, a lot of, you know, a lot of treatment programs out there. And, you know, those are really the mainstay of you know, formal groups that help people make this transition.
We started with your work specifically, Dr. Siegel. I'm curious, I want to close it with that. I'm curious what you're most excited about as you continue to lean into this particular area of medicine and alcohol and just helping people really understand the relationship that their body and their brain has with this drug.
I think the most cutting edge research and findings that really are a game changer in this whole discussion about alcohol is the recent recognition that alcohol is a carcinogen and that alcohol increases the risk of multiple types of cancer. And beyond that, the recent finding that even low doses of alcohol, even moderate drinking or low levels of drinking, increase cancer risk. The Surgeon General last year came out with the first statement that I'm aware of, basically saying that, you know, moderate drinking is associated with increased risk. There was a report from two reports actually from the National Academy of Sciences and from some government health agencies that both concluded that low amounts of alcohol increase risk for cancer. This is especially true for breast cancer. So I think that is a game changer in the way we think about alcohol, because, you know, previously we thought about alcohol as, you know, it's only a problem if you drink beyond moderation. And as long as you drink in moderation, you're fine. And I think what the science is now showing is that that's not true, is that even people who drink at low levels are increasing their carcinogenic risk. The alcohol industry has been, you know, they're trying so hard to avoid that and to try to reframe the issue. And they've been doing this for decades. The alcohol industry wants you to think that the problem of alcohol is just drunkenness. As long as you don't, you know, and that's why they talk about responsible drinking, right? Responsible drinking. They talk about the smart drinking goals, like there's a smart way to drink. And that's their way of increasing their profits, because as soon as people start thinking about alcohol as, you know, a carcinogen, fewer people are gonna drink. And so this is kind of important to their profits, and that's why they work so hard to frame alcohol as, you know, it's only a problem if you overdrink. This has become a really divisive issue and a controversial issue with the government. There was a big debate over the dietary guidelines, which just came out, and what were they going to say about alcohol? And the one of the researchers who was looking at the evidence wanted to put into the recommendations that, you know, letting people know that even at moderate doses, alcohol is a carcinogen and can have increased carcinogenic risk. The administration basically took that out. And so now the recommendation just says, you know, kind of vaguely says, just try to lower your alcohol consumption however you can, however much you can. That's kind of this vague recommendation. It doesn't quantify it. So, you know, to me, this is the game changer. This is the thing that we really need to change the way we talk about alcohol. We need to change the way we educate the public about alcohol. We've got to change this paradigm that, you know, alcohol is a problem if you only because you don't use it in moderation. You know, that's the problem. And the truth, or at least, you know, the evidence base is telling us that that's just not true, that from a public health perspective, alcohol is a problem because it's a carcinogen and because it increases cancer risk, even at low levels. And so we can no longer say that, you know, as long as you drink in moderation, it's it's healthy. I think that the scientific evidence has wiped that out. It's not healthy, even at low levels. It increases cancer risk, even at low levels. And, you know, of course, in public health, we allow people to make their own decisions. We, you know, autonomy, individual autonomy is an important concept in public health. And people need to make their own decisions. And we're not really telling people what they should or shouldn't do. But what is critical in public health is that people make informed decisions. So we want people to make their own decisions autonomously. But the most critical thing in public health is that they make educated decisions, informed decisions. And right now, I don't think people are able to make fully informed decisions because we haven't done a good enough job of conveying to them that alcohol is a carcinogen. If you ask somebody, you know, is tobacco a carcinogen? You know, the majority of people will say, oh yeah, of course, it's a carcinogen. But if you ask people the same thing about alcohol, most people don't really see it as a carcinogen. And it is it's a potent carcinogen. It's a, you know, type one, the highest level of carcinogen that can be identified. So I think it's important that we really start informing people about that. And, you know, they make their own decisions, but at least they understand what the scientific evidence shows.
This is completely random, but I'm curious just to relate this to audience thinking. What are some other quick examples of carcinogens that we would popularly know, just like tobacco?
Well, I think most people, if you mention asbestos to them, they understand that that's really, you know, they have a perception that, wow, that's really bad. And look what happens when a school, you know, when an elementary school is found to have asbestos in it. They, you know, they'll close it down for 6 months while they do a remediation. There's not a lot of evidence that that actually improves the situation. And there's some evidence that it actually makes it worse because now all the asbestos, which was just, you know, kind of covered in one place, is now going all over the place. And so, but people freak out about that, right? They freak out about, you know, the fact that, oh my God, there's some asbestos here. They understand that that's a carcinogen. You know, we mentioned tobacco is the same way.
Yeah, but, you know, I'm like thinking, I know, like asbestos, very like. Once you start categorizing alcohol with asbestos, in my head, it's like they're not the same thing, at least not yet, right? But even in this moment, as you're categorizing them together, my brain is like realigning. And I like, it's going to take some time for me to wrap my head around the fact that that's true, right? Like the evidence supports that it's in the same category as tobacco, asbestos, and many others. As a type one, you said, right?
Yeah, it's the highest level, you know, a definitive carcinogen. There's no doubt about it. So, yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. I think that it is. People don't think about it that way, but if you want to look at it from a public health perspective or a scientific perspective, which is just the way I'm trained to look at things, you know, they're in the same list. There's, you know, you've got arsenic, you've got tobacco, you've got benzene, you've got radon. These are all in the same list. And they, you know, people should actually think of it as being in, you know, in that class. And again, you know, people can make their own decisions, but, you know, if they're making a decision and they're not aware that alcohol is a carcinogen, then that's not truly an informed decision.
Any final thoughts?
I guess, you know, my final thought is that the one way for people to, I think, enhance their ability to cut down on alcohol or abstain from it is to really try to understand the alcohol industry's marketing and, you know, to look at their advertising and to really think about what they're saying and how they're manipulating you. People don't like to be manipulated. And when people see how they're being manipulated and how all of the things that the alcohol industry is doing to try to maintain its profits, that changes things for people. You know, they don't want to be manipulated, and that can be a powerful incentive for people to not let the alcohol industry take all their money. And then one final thing I want to mention is the cost of alcohol. Alcohol is very expensive, as you know, anyone who goes to a bar today knows. It's really expensive what you're paying. And it turns out that for an average person who is a moderate drinker, we're not talking about somebody who goes out drinking every night, but just moderate drinking, the amount of money they spend every year on alcohol is enough to pay for a week-long vacation anywhere, pretty much anywhere. And so I don't think people realize how much they're spending when you add it all up. And so I think that's another thing to think about. You know, you do Dry January and you're able to maintain that, you're going to save literally thousands of dollars in a year, and maybe that will allow you to go on a vacation that you otherwise wouldn't have been able to do.
Interesting. Dr. Siegel, I appreciate your time and the conversation. For those that are listening, if you want more information on alcohol specifically or any other health topic, please visit theeducatedpatient.com and look forward to many more podcasts diving deep into common topics. Not just in health, but also in habits and lifestyle and things that have implications for your health. So Dr. Siegel, thank you again, and have a great day.
Thanks so much for having me.